further than 50 miles away. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 77. Would you explain what that does, Mark, please?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 77 creates Surgical Technology Advisory Committee, requires that certified surgical technologists and certified surgical technologist certified first assistants obtain license to practice in this state. Establishes requirements for licensing, directs Board of Medical Examiners for State of Oregon to adopt rules relating to practice of surgical technology, creates exemption for surgical technologists and first assistants unable to obtain national certification, declares emergency effective on passage.
Thank you very much. We have Senator Morissette, who has been the victim of several surgeries, here to testify first.
Deborah, would you
want to bring your folks up? That's fine, too.
Someone from the Board of Medicine. But they have not signed in the test.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's good to know.
Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify, but you mentioned I was a victim of several surgeries, and on my last hip surgery, I was lying on a gurney at 6:30 in the morning, and I looked up and I saw the surgical technician, Deborah Turner, taking care of me. And I was thankful and impressed, because one of the concerns that I have is the patient safety issue. And I think that, well, we call it medical errors, or to be positive about it, we call it patient safety. And I think that there are some potential for problems in the surgical, in the room, unless all of the people there are highly trained, certified, have credentials. That's not the case today. There are people potentially who can come in off the street, literally, and work in a room where very dangerous, important surgery is taking place. So that prompted my concern about the certification for the assistants. And I just want to call your attention to the letters. I had intended to quote from some of them, but I won't. There are 10 or 12 letters that you have. There are also a number of signatures from people who are concerned about the issue. Many of them are nurses. And I guess I would close my part of the testimony by acknowledging the fact that this does come down to a turf battle, so to speak, and we have a lot of them coming before us in the legislature. Dealing with scope of practice, I believe that those issues can be very clearly delineated so there's no confusion in the future about who's in charge of the room when the doctor is not there. I think that can be determined. There is a scope of practice that puts the nurse in charge. I don't know that the surgical assistants would challenge that, but it could be fortified, I guess, if we found that as a problem. So the bottom line to me is that I think the surgical assistants do deserve their own association. I think they ought to be licensed under the Board of Examiners. They are not nurses. They are a different scope of practice, and I would hope that there can be an agreement. And I hope this bill will pass out of the committee onto the floor of the Senate. So with that, I will stop and thank you very much.
Thanks, Senator. Ms. Turner, do you want to go next, or how do you have this?
I can go next.
Okay.
Not exactly sure of the protocol, though.
I'll just give your name for the record, and then you can begin your testimony.
My name is Deborah Turner. I'm a certified surgical technologist, certified first assistant. I work for Orthopedic Healthcare Northwest in Eugene, Springfield. The surgical technologist is the only professional who works in the operating room now currently that is not licensed. Everyone else in the operating room is licensed. The surgical technologists are the only professionals specifically educated to work in the operative environment. There are over 350 schools that are currently accredited through a formal accreditation process. Surgical technologists have a system of educational standards developed over 30 years ago. Surgical technologists are graduates of diploma, certificate, and associate's degree programs. A professional's educational base is the cornerstone of its growth and development. Competent and humanistic practice is a healthcare professional's demands a broad base of knowledge and the development of intelligent skills as well as technical proficiency. What constitutes an adequate educational program today will not be sufficient for tomorrow's practitioner as the role of the surgical technologist continues to expand. Increasing responsibilities demand a more broadly based, prepared curriculum to remain on a par with other allied health professions. Surgical technology must maintain the same educational standards. In Oregon, we have two surgical technology programs accredited through CAHAP. CAHAP is the Commission on Accreditation of Allied Health Education Programs. These two programs are in Mount Hood Community College. They have an associate's degree. And then Southwestern Community College in Coos Bay, they have a 15-month certificate program. We are a profession that is delegated to by multiple professions, the MD, the PA, the DO, dentist, and the nurse. We provide the care in multiple settings, example, clinics, day surgeries, hospitals, and in these hospitals, operating rooms, central supply, x-ray department, and then in the x-ray department, we assist with cardiac cath and pacemakers. In some of these situations, there may not be a nurse present. We are instead working under the direction of the primary provider in such settings and clinics where they perform surgery. An example of that is some eye surgery clinics do not have nurses employed there. Our goal is to provide safe, quality care to surgical patients. To achieve this goal, we feel that licensing of this profession should be mandatory. Licensing would allow the state of Oregon to begin to provide the public a level of protection that they are not able to provide themselves. Through the development of education and certification standards similar to the other professionals in the operating room and to impose the high standards already agreed upon by the profession to protect the public. We do not wish to affect those qualified individuals who have already been providing quality patient care in this state, so we have a grandfather clause written in our bill. I want to thank you today for your time and for listening. I have been in the field of surgical technology now for 27 years, 15 of those years in the state of Oregon. I want to leave you with something to think about. What if you or a member of your family is on the operating room table? Would you know if that person that's passing instruments to the surgeon is a qualified surgical technologist who has been through an appropriate program that has been accredited? Probably not. I work in the healthcare profession. I know who those people are that work in the operating room, and I can request to have someone in that room that is qualified. But the general public do not know this. The opportunity is there now for the legislators of our state to ensure quality, safe care for everyone. Thank you.
Deborah, I just have one question. Just out of curiosity, what was your training?
My training?
Mm-hmm.
I trained at a Boone Hospital Center, Columbia Health Occupations, as a surgical technologist, and then as a first assistant, Colorado Surgical Assisting. And I did a 2-year preceptorship to become a first assistant.
I see. So you basically have two areas of training then?
Yes, I have a certification both in surgical technology and in first assisting.
And this was from Colorado?
The first assisting was from Colorado Surgical Assisting, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. I was just curious about what you're training with.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Now it's your turn.
Hi, my name is Chris Walton. I'm an orthopedic surgeon with Orthopedic Healthcare Northwest in Eugene, Springfield. We're a group of 15 orthopedic surgeons. We employ two physician assistants and three certified first assists. currently and are in the process of hiring a fourth certified first assist slash surgical tech. As a physician, we rely on the certified surgical techs as first assists anymore because realistically of a person power shortage, we need good qualified people. We require those individuals that we have hired to be certified in their profession, and we feel that it would be a step forward in, for the state of Oregon to have a statewide credentialing process. The tech is explicitly under our control, maybe a little strong, but under our direction, both the scrub tech for the case and the assist in the case. For those of you who don't know, very simplistically, an operating room is set up with a scrub tech, which is the person who hands instruments back and forth at the request of the surgeon, and occasionally at the request of the first assistant. And the first assistant is a person who is assisting the surgeon with the actual surgical procedure directly. That person, the first assistant, may not only help with the exposure, but on occasion helps with the various, what we call, closure of the incision and placement of dressings after surgery. Those people are under our direction at all times. And I guess a question has come up as to what happens if, say, I leave the room and the assistant is closing. I'm no further than the recovery room, but at that point in time, our understanding is that at that time the anesthesiologist is in control of the room. At all times, if you will, the buck stops here. It stops with me, the physician. If there are a question, the tech calls us back into the room to look at something, so they are solely under our direction. I'd also add that I am the coordinator for the techs in our group. We review them on a yearly basis and sit down and have an objective job evaluation with them. And we would, as I said, we would welcome the state's development of a universal criteria or universal credentialing process for them. I think that does eliminate a degree of concern and for licensing. Okay.
Doctor, would you know if OMA has taken any position on endorsement of this bill?
I do not.
Okay. Any questions of Dr. Walton?
No, not of Dr. Walton.
Okay.
Ms. Turner.
Okay, Ms. Turner, would you respond to a question, please, Senator Menes?
I know we spoke a couple of days ago. It helped me understand again. What do you have a certification now as a technician, or what's the standard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Menes, the certification that I now hold is a certified surgical technologist and certified first assistant.
Okay, certified through who or
the liaison council on certification, and I do believe that information is in your packet.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that. So where does that happen at?
Okay, that is a group that has been accredited, and through they have a testing system with the ARCST, and they are accredited, and they're through Colorado.
All right, so it's like a national organization.
Yes.
You take
well,
tests.
They're not a national organization.
I just happen to be here from that organization.
Oh, no.
I could go into that a little further.
Okay, you're our resident expert for now.
Yes.
Sure. Would you please identify yourself?
Sure. My name's Ben Price, and I'm the Government and Public Affairs Director from the Association of Surgical Technologists. And we work very closely with the Liaison Council on Certification for Surgical Technologists. They've been in place for around 30 years now. They're a nationally accredited certifying agency that administers the Certified Surgical Technologist Examination and also the Certified Surgical Technologist Certified First Assistant Examination.
Okay. All right, so I guess, Mr. Chair, follow-up question.
Sure.
So given that a person in this field passes the test or the examination and becomes certified, what does licensure buy you that is in addition to? What does it bring to the table? What does it benefit?
Accountability. accountability and responsibility for our profession, because there are many people out there who are not certified. Okay, so we want to make sure we have accountability.
So there are people working in the field who do not have certification.
That is correct.
Is that correct? At all, even through this?
It's voluntary at this point.
I see. Okay.
I think Senator Minnis, in my discussions with Ms. Turner, she pointed out that in some hospitals in Oregon, they basically do on-the-job training of untrained workers, and it's hard to quantify when they become, you know, up and running surgical technicians.
Okay. And do we know if there's a point at which they ultimately take the test and then become certified to continue in their employment, or?
I can answer that. They, as of March of 2000, you can no longer take the exam if you have not been through an accredited program.
Okay.
The accredited program is the KHEP program I spoke about earlier.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have any other comments that you wanted to make?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Thank you for allowing us to present our bill today. As I said, I'm from the National Association, and we appreciate the state of Oregon looking at this type of legislation. We think it's important because of something we were just discussing, and that is that at this point, certification and showing that you're actually qualified to work in this field is on the person and on the hospital to make the decision who's qualified to work in the operating room. And we've watched nationwide with alarm the rise in medical errors and also the increase in the number of hospitals who are hiring people off the street with 2 to 3 weeks of training and putting them in the operating room. The patients can't protect themselves primarily because they don't know we exist. If you ask the average patient on the street who's in the operating room, they're going to say, well, there's doctors and nurses. And the fact is that there's a lot of other people in the operating room, and we're the only ones who are not regulated at this point. We feel that SB 77 is important to protecting the public. We think that safe patient care requires minimum educational standards, credentialing proof of knowledge similar to our national certification, but we think that it's important that the state begin to require that by regulating our people who work in the field, and at the same time, it's important to make them accountable to the state in the event that anything should occur. One important note is that with SB 77, we do not want to put anyone out of a job. Traditionally, since the time of the Civil War, surgical technologists have been trained on the job. It's only been within the last 30 years that the formal accredited schooling process has come into play and the certification process, and there are many people who have been working for 15 or 20 years in the field that are fully qualified to work, and we were careful to put language in the bill that would allow those individuals to continue to work. Some other states are already looking at legislation of this type. Texas became the first state in 2001 to pass a surgical assisting licensure law, and in this current legislative session, they're also looking at a surgical technologist licensure law. Illinois, Kentucky, Georgia, and Tennessee are all actively looking at legislation at this point that's very similar to SB 77. And we believe that these states have begun to see the danger inherent to having someone in the operating room who's not regulated by the state. We understand that some other groups may raise some questions about who the most appropriate board to oversee the surgical technologists are, and we agree that there is still room for discussion on that issue. Our initial look at it would say that the Board of Medical Examiners would be most appropriate because of the delegatory relationship between the physician and the surgical technologist. The simple physical fact of the matter is that in the operating room, the surgeon is across the table from the surgical technologist, and we're together in the sterile field, and he is the one who delegates to us the tasks that we do. So we feel that that would be most appropriate, but there is room for discussion about some other boards if that would work better for the state. But we appreciate the opportunity to present our bill to you, and we appreciate you having a look at it, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, we have Ladina Heaton, Doug Martindale, and Alan Boyden. Did you want to speak? No? Okay. Then, let's go to Susan King, bring anybody up with you, you can, Ms. King. Anybody except Mr. Taylor, I should say.
Did he do something today I don't know about?
No,
usually.
Yeah. I just don't want to cry yet. So, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. You normally see me in the capacity of the Oregon Nurses Association. Today, I'm actually representing the American Operating Room Nurses Association. And this is a panel of three folks who come to you as somewhat reluctant opponents to this bill. We believe that there is an opportunity to find a bill that everyone involved in the nursing and surgical tech world could agree to, but we're not there yet. And so I want to hand out something for the committee, and I think Susan may start our comment.
I'll have some written testimony for you here. Many of the points that are included in my testimony on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association have been made already.
You will tell us who you are.
Yes. My name is Susan King, administrator for the Oregon Nurses Association, clinical practices in emergency nursing. It is true, as has been mentioned already, that in today's hospitals, at least, and in clinics as well, there are a variety of people providing patient care, some of whom are not regulated either by licensure or certification or registration. We have seen over the last few years the proliferation of a variety of technical positions. Surgical technologists are one of those technical positions that has arisen primarily in hospitals. Within the OR, the registered nurse is responsible for the management of the surgical unit, including the decisions about procedure scheduling, staff assignments, and interventions when changes in condition occur, working with the operating surgeon. The emergence of the technical roles that we've been speaking about has come through both formal and what we call on-the-job training. The result, of course, is that there's a lack of clarity about the competencies that technicians are expected to possess in all settings. Facilities have developed job descriptions, as we've seen over the past few years, which don't have a clear understanding of whether the duties match with the knowledge and the skill base of those filling the job. While ONA does not support Senate Bill 77 in its current form, I do believe that the bill offers an opportunity to standardize the training required to become a surgical technologist, to specify the authorized duties, and to set forth a regulatory scheme that can help assure patients, nurses, and physicians that minimum standards have been met. In the hospital where I practice, we all dress the same, and every day that I am on the job in my clinical practice, patients express to me a desire to know who it is that's caring for them. And so we spend a lot of time clarifying that this person wearing blue scrubs is a nurse and that person wearing blue scrubs is a physician. And so I do think the points that have been made already, that the public has a right to know who is providing their care and to be assured that that individual is competent, is a very salient point. We have discussed the concerns that we have about this bill with Senator Morissette and with representatives of the Surgical Technologist Group, and we're continually hopeful that discussions can result in agreement around some critical elements, and let me outline for you what those are. First of all, the level of regulation. ONA is recommending certification. Certification would regulate the specific occupational title of surgical technologists and set forth the standards an individual must meet to use that title. Second of all, standardized training. I believe this is the most compelling argument for regulating surgical technologists, as patients in healthcare facilities have a right to expect that staff providing care are trained and competent to provide the care to which they are assigned. The third element would be the specification of authorized duties. However, we would exclude first assistant. The authorized duties can be specified in administrative rule, much like has already been done for other categories of assistive personnel. However, it is our belief that the first assistant in an expanded role is a practice that is outside the scope of a surgical technologist. And then fourth, our recommendation is regulation by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Since the role of the surgical technologist primarily includes duties that are either performed by nurses or under the assignment and supervision of nurses, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, in our opinion, is the most appropriate regulatory agency. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Ms. King, the one question that occurs to me is if the training for the surgical technicians does not involve nursing training per se, then why would the Board of Nursing be the appropriate venue for them?
Senator Corcoran, I think the way that I view this is that the role of a surgical technologist, although admittedly they may function in outpatient settings such as dental offices, physician offices, but there are a variety of people that practice in those settings. It's technically what we call a carve-out, in that what surgical technologists do is generally performed by nurses. Or, particularly in hospitals, the hospital licensure rules require that every patient in the hospital is not only under the care of a physician, but is under the care of a registered nurse. And so it is the registered nurse that has to make decisions about who is assigned to do what aspect of care. So in many cases, what a surgical technologist does is a carve-out, a piece of the technical skills of what a nurse would do.
Thank you. Senator Minnis, did you have a question?
No, I...
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Breckenridge. I am a registered nurse, also a CNOR, which is a national certification for perioperative nursing. I'm also president of the Oregon State Council of Perioperative Nurses, also a manager of perioperative services at Providence Newburgh Hospital. And my testimony basically is to kind of support to echoes what the ONA says, but also describe a little bit more of the majority of the practice setting of the perioperative registered nurse as well as surgical technologist, and that is in the acute care setting, and that's at the hospital. And as Susan has referred to, that the patient is under the care of the physician as well as under the care of the nurse, and that it is a delegated responsibility, that of the surgical scrub position of which the technologist fills. There are many hospitals that have all RN staffs in their operating room, of which it's the RN that does both the scrub and the circulating role. The RN must be, or the circulator must be an RN, but could also be the scrub too as well. And that in many practice settings that have the combination of the RN and the surgical technologist, it's a collaborative planning of the care that basically comes under the nursing care plan, working together, and that very much do we support the basic concepts of the bill, but that there needs to be some adjustment to it also.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, on behalf of the American Operating Room Nurses,
Association of
I want to start by sort of giving you a sense of the history of this as a turf battle, because it was described by Senator Morissette to begin with as a turf battle. And I simply want to say that this may be the beginning of the last stage of a turf battle. It's true that surgical technologists, to the extent that they have a scope of practice that's contained within nursing and are they have less credentials, less qualifications, and similarly have less pay, have been seen as a way of de-skilling the nursing population. If you had similar experiences in each of the different parts of nursing, you wouldn't have nurses anymore. You'd have a lot of technicians. That's been historic concern with this field. There is now perhaps a more important concern, which is the one that's been described to you, that there are folks practicing as surgical technologists who are really not safe to be doing patient care based on the way we're getting them frequently in the on-the-job training model that the Senator Corcoran has described. What we'd like to be able to do is move in a direction where we can find a way to have surgical technicians, but we're going to retain the right to expect quality in that field. The way Senate Bill 77 was first presented to you, there is a very serious issue with quality. It's full licensure as opposed to a first step in the process of having a scope of practice, which would typically be certification. It is grandfathering in folks who have come into the field of surgical technology in the very manner that people have described as a risk to patient care. We can't, at this point, support Senate Bill 77. We can work with all the parties involved to try to get to a better outcome. And I think that that's what we're trying to describe. This is a work in progress. I've submitted to you a list of notes from a meeting that took place between about 8 operating room nurses and about a dozen surgical techs. And we had really 6 issues that we boiled the conversation around Senate Bill 77 down to. You'll see on the grid that 3 of those 6 places, I think we were able to reach a level of consensus. Now, those are not reflected today by any amendments. We're not having a work session. But it's our hope that those would become starting points for amendments to this bill. Senate Bill 77 would require that surgical techs present evidence of national certification or national accreditation as a requirement to become a licensed surgical technician. That's an education requirement that we would hope in time could be accomplished as a 2-year associate's degree. And I think that there was general consensus that that would be an approach that we could go towards, but that there needed to be some time to build up the capacity in the state to get there. So we would do that in 2007. That was a product of a discussion between these folks at a single table. There's also the issue of grandfathering, which we also agreed we could reach by 2007 a level of expectation where folks who have been practicing as surgical techs would at least get a national accreditation, and everybody knew after the law's passage would have to have that 2-year degree. Those are examples of where this discussion has taken place. I don't want to reread the entire notes to you. I think where you're finding a gap right now in this discussion is that we didn't finish it. Before, as time expired in our meeting, we never got to the 6th point, which was to describe the scope of practice. And we never really hammered out the really very important issue in this bill, which is what board would oversee the newly created surgical technician. I feel like we've been making a good faith effort on both sides of the table to start this discussion, and what we need is an opportunity to complete it. I would say that I'm thankful that Deborah Turner, who's really been a leader among the surgical techs, has been willing to engage in the conversation so far. I'm certainly thankful to Senator Morissette in his guidance in trying to get us together. But I would say that at this point, that job's not complete. And if we're going to do this with quality, do this right, we need a little bit more time to work together.
Thank you very much. Senator Bennis?
Barton, I'm a little troubled by your comment about the desire to put everybody into a community college and have to go through an associate's program to get an associate's degree to become one of these technicians, when there may very well be an on-the-job training mechanism. Some combination of training and on-the-job experience may serve very well for this particular quote-unquote carve-out, as Ms. King said. So that seems to be kind of out of the scope of what the bill is really attempting to do. And when we start talking about medical error issues, it occurs to me that the vast majority of medical errors are that reported are accomplished by individuals who are currently licensed practitioners in medicine. So to me, that's kind of an irrelevant or moot point. And I understand at least the initial premise that you want people to be competent, but competency is generally determined by people who are actually doing the job and the peers that are overseeing them at the time, which relates to supervision and so on and so forth. So I'm trying to evaluate this particular group of individuals want to professionalize a group of individuals for which they think there needs to be professionalization of some sort. And that seems like a good thing. So it really seems the only question in my mind is, you know, how you get there, whether it's a board of medical examiners or a board of nursing. Frankly, I think at this point I don't care. I don't think it really makes to me a lot of difference. I do, I guess, in so far the testimony would seem to me, since these functions are carve-outs of nursing practice, and generally nurses do operate under the direction of physicians, I think if I'm correct, and so do these technologists, it would probably make sense to put in the board of nursing. And so really, I think you're left with the core of how do you do that? And so it seems like a very simple process to me. And as opposed to putting all these things on the table and, you know, having a lot of subterfuge, I think we're going to just get down to it and make it happen.
Senator Parker. I think that's, to some degree, Senator Menes, the hope that this public hearing will prompt the parties to go back and have a discussion.
and come up with something that everybody can go along with. There's other players in this as well, and we'll hear from some of them.
And Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with you. I guess I'm saying this because it does seem to me like it's a fairly important topic. What I wouldn't want to see happen is everybody kind of go off in a corner and the whole idea go away. Because I do think there's merit in the professor, and sometimes the chair of a committee can influence the outcome.
Well, I learned at the knees of a very bright man by the name of Representative Chuck Norris on water policy in 95, who basically took all the players in a room and said, get it settled, and he left the room. And he said, always remember the last part, the legislators leave the room. Then they can actually get something settled.
So, good point. Okay.
Okay, thank you folks very much. Any other questions? No? Thank you. Catherine Bain, I don't know which, you're a neutral, it says here?
Yeah, I'm neutral.
Okay. We like neutrality in this 15 to 15 Senate. What can we do for you today?
Okay. I'm a surgical technologist. My name is Catrin Bain. I am not certified. I went to a two-year program at Mount Hood Community College and got my associate's degree. One of the reasons I wasn't certified is because it's not mandatory. I think it should be mandatory. I also think that the education should be mandatory to a two-year degree. I know that people don't agree with me. I know that they think that it should be learned on the job. I was one of the few people at Mount Hood Community College, one of the last of the few people, who had to go through a two-part interview. I was taught by RNs, and I thought I'd give everyone a chance to know that I do believe that we should be regulated in some way, whether it be through the OMA or through AORN. I'm impressed with the fact that AORN cared enough to show up. I don't see anyone with the OMA.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Senator Menes?
Sure, Ms. Bain. Thank you very much, because I disagree with you on the two-year degree program.
Okay.
Because we're battling other issues with respect to how can we get capacity at Mount Hood Community College and other facilities to get two-year nursing students into those programs, because we have a substantial shortage of RNs. So if we load up programs with surgical technology students, that takes as a capacity issue. It isn't that you wouldn't ultimately do it. I think given where we are right now, it's not practical. But the question I have for you is, what things have you seen in your practice that are inherently bad that you would want to have regulated, that this would help do, or would help regulate?
Inherently bad.
What have you seen that you think needs to be regulated that's wrong and bad and something evil that's happened that the government needs to correct?
No, I think it's more of a question of accountability. I've seen a lot of surgical technologists that have no business being in the room.
In what manner? Why? Why would they have no business being there? What makes them incompetent or incapable?
Tell us the behavior.
Thinking ahead. My education is not just being the person across from the physician. My education included the whole scope of being in the OR. I know how to open an OR. I know how to set up an OR. I know how to sterilize anything. That's one of the things that hasn't been brought up, is that our expertise is also used in sterilization, making sure that what you have on that field has not been contaminated by something, has not been improperly used, or has a chemical on it that you don't need. And that's what I learned in my two-year degree. Now, I have seen many people who learned on the job that don't get that education. Now, if I'm standing at the table and I realize that I'm holding something that's got chemical residue on it, I learned that because that was my second year in surgical training. And I spent a full year just doing what a lot of people would refer to as an internship, where I worked on the job at OHSU. And my first year was just learning, just a knowledge base. I think everyone needs some education out there.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just for the record, we have Diana Dolstra, who's the administrator of the License Service Section of the Board of Medical Examiners, and she submitted a document expressing their neutrality and didn't give any indication that she needed to. Is Ms. Dolstra here? Didn't give any indication that she needed to testify, per se. Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could I ask a question relevant to the document that was submitted by the Board of Medical Examiners? And maybe
come on up, Board of Medical Examiners,
put it on the record, and maybe for the Board of Nursing, if they're here too, because there was a fiscal kind of summary that was put into the record. And I didn't see in that analysis any additional rent or space for the new employees and such, so I wanted to question the fiscal.
Is there anybody here from the Board of Nurses?
No. Board of Medical. This is the Board of Medical Examiners.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Board of Medical Examiners, and with me is Diana Dolstra, who's on the staff of the board, to answer your questions. And could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
I'm looking through the figures that have been placed in here. We've got $115,000 for personal services and supplies. The first year, $117,000, 2005-07, and then there's some additional rules, administrative rules, preparation, applications, new materials, et cetera, but what I don't see, because there's a mention of new staff, whether or not you've accommodated or accounted for the cost of space.
No, the space is already, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Dr. Senator Minus, space is already available. We wouldn't have to have any extra space.
All right.
We have.
So you already have the space and the capacity.
Yeah, it would be one. I believe it would be one additional FTE to handle the extra certification or licensing of the surgical technologist, surgical assistants. As I said, okay. The estimate of the number of the people that would be licensed or certified is an estimate only. I don't know if we know how many there are.
All right, Mr. Chairman, the Board of Nursing, are they here?
They are not.
No.
Okay. Because I guess what I don't know is, do they have the space?
I see. Maybe we could ask one of the interested parties to communicate with the Board of Nursing and get that answer. I see Mr. Taylor's nodding his head, so we'll do that.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
And if I might add one thing just to clarify the board's position, Mr. Chair. They are neutral on the issue of licensing this profession, but they're willing to take on the responsibility. They also have no objection to the Board of Nursing taking it on as well, or instead of. Thank you.
Very much. Okay, now we have Joe Bell, please, from the Hospital Association, and Bruce Bishop, or Bruce Bishop. You're no Joe Bell. I know Joe Bell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I am appearing on behalf of Joe Bell for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems is not now taking a position on Senate Bill 77. We have a general policy position that opposes the establishment of new health profession licensing boards and regulations. But at the request of Senator Morissette, we have been meeting with the proponents of the legislation to understand their proposal. We did that last week, and we are in the process of surveying our hospital members to formulate a position on this specific legislation. We have not yet taken a position on it, and we will be pleased to advise the committee when we are able to do that. As a technical matter, I would only point out that we are concerned with the way the bill is drafted, that it would prohibit anybody from practicing surgical technology. But we don't believe that the legislation actually defines what that is. And so there may be a need to have more specificity if a bill is going to proceed as to what that practice would be or how that would be determined.
Okay.
And we will let the committee know when we have taken a position on the bill.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you, Senator.
Take care. Okay, is there anybody else wanting to testify on this matter? Seeing no one, we will close the... Oh, Senator Minnis?
Just one question somebody may have an answer to. What about liability insurance? Who's liable in the event that a technologist makes a mistake?
Is that... You want to come up and answer that, please? This is Ben Price from the Association of Surgical Technologists.
Mr. Chair, it's Senator Minnis, there has been a liability insurance program in place for years for surgical technologists. They, even though they have not been regulated by the states, they have been held in court to be liable for malpractice in certain instances. It's been very rare. Primarily, I think, because we've been sort of invisible in the operating room, and the people that are looking at these cases haven't really known who's in there. But it does happen, and there are companies that provide for malpractice insurance.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. I guess the follow-up question, does every surgical technologists carry liability insurance, and does licensure subsequently raise the status of it and potentially increase the rates?
It didn't. When they brought in licensure in the state of Texas, the rates did not increase.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing. Did you have something you wanted to talk about, Mrs. Turner? Briefly.
Senator Corcoran, I'll make it really brief. I just have a few things I'd just like to point out.
Mm-hmm.
There are some revisions that we have asked for in the bill that are not in the bill currently.
Okay.
And would you like me to go over those?
You know what I would really prefer is that you and the nurses and Mr. Bishop have a work group and try to get your differences resolved so that we can move this bill. So you don't really have to share that with us now. It's more important from a process standpoint that that you guys have a discussion and put a bill together for us.
The other thing that I have is I have been in contact with the Healthcare Licensing and Certification Office.
Okay.
And so they are now looking into the possibility of us going underneath their office.
Okay.
They license all the hospitals, outpatient clinics, day surgeries in the state.
Okay.
And they also license the hemodialysis tech. I also have copies from regarding the grandfather clause for the physician's assistant and how that was done. I also have from the Nurses Practice Act for the state of Oregon, their delegation and how that is done, and I'll be glad to share that with you. And I just want to leave you also with, it is our position that what we do is not nursing and is not nursing practice, and what we do is not nursing task.
Okay. Thank you very much. And you're welcome to submit that information to Mr. Ellsworth, and we'll put it, we'll get copies to everybody and put it in for the record. And but most importantly, I hope you guys will continue to have a dialogue, because it seems like it's something that can be done. So in this business, you just try to eliminate the negatives, the obstacles. So you folks keep on talking, and then we'll be in communication with Senator Morissette. And when you've got a resolution, we'll have a work session.
Thank you for meeting with us today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Close public hearing. And we will move to House Bill 2192, open a public hearing. And would you please tell us what this does, Mark?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2192 modifies duties of program director of Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, exempts Corps members from prevailing wage law.
Thank you very much. I see we have the former representative, Ron Adams, here. Welcome, my colleague in the House back in 95 and 97. But I see you're also still up to your old tricks of filling in that you live more than 100 miles from this location.
Yes.
Okay. Welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, my name is Terry Johansson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. We are here to talk to you today about House Bill 2192. I'll talk to you about the first couple of parts of this, which clarify the relationship between the program director for OYCC and the Commissioner of Community Colleges. And then I'll ask Ron to speak to you about the prevailing wage part of this bill, and also the friendly amendment that he has brought forward to you. As all the agencies are doing, look to streamline and clarify the relationships of our programs within our department, we've taken a look at ORS 418, which is the authorizing legislation for the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and just bring before you today kind of a housekeeping bill around clarifying the relationship of the program director to the commissioner of our department, and our board, the State Board of Education, education. So there are several places on pages 1, 2, and 3, and several lines of the statute that clarify the fact that the OYCC is part of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and therefore the director works with, in collaboration and consideration with the commissioner, and also the rules that might govern OYCC would come before the State Board of Education. So those are merely housekeeping and cleanup and clarification. So we hope that you will see your way clear to move them right along. So, Ron, you want to talk about prevailing wage?
Thank you, Ms. Johansson. Any questions, Ms. Johansson? Okay. Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Ron Adams, Program Director of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. And the prevailing wage piece, what happens, what we've run into?
Oh, go ahead. Just go ahead. I'll be
sure. And is that we only put about $11,000 every summer into counties, but we then ask for a one-to-one match. And in certain situations, the local folks have been so successful in putting together pieces that we will end up with a single contract or project that's over $25,000, and then we fall under prevailing wage. And this has not been a big difficulty for us, but nevertheless it has created situations, and the most recent one, Mr. Chair, was the Eugene Wetlands project, where we've worked down there with Corps of Engineers and BLM and OEB and others, and last summer, with the purchase of a new piece of property, it became much more than $25,000. They wanted to give the work, to have our kids do the work, because we typically have worked out there in the summer, and they simply could not because it had fallen under prevailing wage. I have been visiting with Boley for Bureau of Labor and Industry for several months, and finally we came up with the legislation that would exempt us from prevailing wage. I've been in contact with them. They, I don't believe, are here today. I did visit with them yesterday, and they had some questions. They had some concerns regarding how we might work in the future and so forth. I'd be happy to answer any of those. I think the assurances are there that we would not do things that would. In fact, it's already in statute that we cannot take jobs from existing employees or replace laid off employees, and that's very clearly spelled out in everything I do. When I put out grad guidelines, it's in there, and we follow through on that and check on it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Adams. I do have a couple of questions and clarification that you can help me with. The concern that I think Boley and certainly I would have, the labor community would probably have, is that understanding the wonderful work that you do in this program, and I truly mean that. I mean, it's an excellent, excellent program. Working with these kids that need a chance and need some hands-on work, so at-risk, disadvantaged kids, it's just wonderful work. But there's always concern that that something like this can create a situation where other worthy exemptions are looking at the prevailing wage too. So I guess what I want to ask you is, it's my understanding that most OYCC projects are not currently covered by prevailing wage law.
We will often, if I might, Mr. Chair, just a little bit, we'll often leverage our dollars by more than the one-to-one match, which would take us up to $20,000, $22,000. But it's on multiple projects with multiple sponsors. When we run into it is a situation like at Eugene Wetlands, where the total project now becomes a large number. They'd love to use the kids, and it just doesn't work.
Okay. I think you pretty much answered this next question. Does OYCC generally receive matching funds from nonprofits or other entities? And is it that combined amount of funding that at times results in the project being covered by the prevailing wage rate?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. We don't put out grants that would go above that number.
And if OYCC received this proposed exemption, does OYCC plan or envision running its program any differently?
Only when we have that opportunity, which again is not that regular, really. But no, I don't see us running it differently at all.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That clarifies questions I had. Any other questions?
And Mr. Chairman, I guess from what you've said, there's no intent to, you know, subvert the prevailing wage law with kids in this category and displace jobs. I think you said that earlier. That was not the intent. So.
No, absolutely not, Mr. Chair, Senator Menes. The situation you have to, I think, understand is that I'm hiring youth 16 to 18. There are many jobs they can't do. 75% must be disadvantaged or at risk. And these are not great employees. These are not skilled employees. We're trying to teach them those pieces. And if someone needs to pay a prevailing wage or if they need to get full benefit for the wage that they're paying, they should hire regular employees. They should not be hiring our kids. That's the things we're trying to teach them, show up on time and the work ethic.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menes?
I may be premature on this, but there's a letter from you, Ron, talking about an amendment to the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Menes. I did ask for one friendly amendment, and we can move into that if the prevailing wage questions are finished.
Yes, and I mean, in terms of the amendment, just get it. We'll get it drafted for you, and then we'll just do the work session. We'll be. I don't sense any angst over this bill, so. But we'll have to technically get the amendment.
Correct.
How necessary is the amendment, and what's the purpose of the stupid?
Or can we get it done on the other?
It's basically where it plays the most difference. If we're working with Open Meadow in North Portland or Looking Glass or Phoenix School down in Roseburg, nobody much cares whether it says community service or something else. We're expanding the program, and when I get down into Nestucca, for example, Hebo Cloverdale, Nestucca High School, the kids are concerned that all of a sudden the label is community service program, and they're afraid that they will be tagged as having mandated community service from the judicial system. And so we just, my advisory committee had suggested we change the name to stewardship. Does the world come to an end, Senator Menes, if it doesn't change? No.
That's the will of the committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have no problems making the amendments conceptually and just simply have you check it as it comes out. If there's a problem, you can hold it up or send it back. I know some people get really antsy about that, but I was here in the building when we actually amended them line by line, so I'm fine with it. I know where they're going, and it makes sense.
And I actually enjoy making people antsy.
Good.
So I think between the two of us, we probably agree on this.
Great. Well,
can we make a motion?
Yes. Well, let's go into work session. Close public hearing, go into work session on House Bill 2192.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr?
I'd move that we conceptually amend House Bill 2192 to substitute the word service as it relates to Community Service Corps, and substituted the word service for stewardship, so it would read Community Stewardship Corps. And it's listed here on page 1, line 31, page 2, line 1, 6, 11, and 18. That would be the amendment.
Okay, and does that take care of your needs? Okay. The proposal is to amend the bill as listed. The changes that are requested would be on page 1, line 31, page 2, line 1, line 6, line 11, line 18. In each case, the word stewardship would be substituted for service.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
This is a matter of procedure. I want to just make sure we may need to suspend the rules to do this because it's been a while since I've looked at the rules, but I think our rules refer to having LC draft. So if I could perhaps ask that we include in the motion that we suspend the rules and do the following.
Good. So noted.
Good point.
So noted. Okay, so we have the motion is to suspend the rules for the purpose of this change.
Aye.
Any objections?
No objections.
Hearing none. So ordered. Do I hear another motion here?
The motion then would be to move the bill to the floor as conceptually amended.
Okay, thank you very much. The motion is to move the bill to the floor as conceptually amended. Any questions? Any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2192. Good work. Yep. That would be a good idea. And let's see, we could make Representative Senator Walker carry it, but that probably wouldn't be nice. How about since Senator Starr did such a wonderful job, we'll let him carry it.
Very good.
And you can talk to Senator Starr. But he is such a silver-tongued devil that he probably won't need much help.
Silver-tongued saint.
Silver-tongued saint. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks for that correction, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have anybody else on these other bills that are from a long distance? I haven't checked, but no. Why don't we go ahead and do Senate Bill 347 then, please? We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 347. Mark, can you tell us what that does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 347 increases the fee for filing certificates of death.
Can't you be a little more lively than that, Mark?
Can you file them before they actually die?
Okay, this is the, and before Senator Menace and Senator Starr make any jokes about finding a new group of people to tax, we will have the witnesses come up, please. And who do we have the witness? This
looks like Mr. Sorry.
That's right. David. We have David Koch, Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board.
Right.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Koch. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. First, I'd like to thank Senator Corcoran, with whom I communicated by email, for helping us get this bill introduced. It was, in a literal sense, lost in the transition, and we very much appreciate your efforts in that respect.
As long as it wasn't a dead issue. We're not going to have too many more issues.
You can make those sorts of jokes. I think I'll forbear.
Okay.
What you have before you is some written testimony, four pages and some attachments. I know that it's been a long day for all of you. First, in the written presentation is some background information on the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and I would be happy to go over that with you just to give you a thumbnail of the board's programs and responsibilities. Then there's a section describing the revenue shortfall that led to the board's legislative concept with respect to Senate Bill 347. Then I talk a little bit about the board's fee structure and the death certificate filing fee, and talk about some alternatives that the board has considered. Would you like me to present you with some background information about the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, or go directly to the issue with respect to the revenue shortfall?
I see Senator Menace is interested in going to. I just will note for the record, though, that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board played a role in the trust fund case down in Medford, which was people have heard about, and they've done quite a few complaint investigations, and so I think we're all aware of your value, and I think probably primarily what we would like to hear is, why do you want the fee increase? Why are we doing? You explained to me that why you're doing it this way as opposed to doing it in another fashion, and just sort of get to the heart of it. I think that would be fine.
Okay. First of all, the board receives no general fund, lottery fund, or federal fund revenue. The board's programs are supported solely by other fund revenue derived from two principal sources: a variety of license fees authorized under the board's administrative rules, and a portion of the death certificate filing fee set forth in ORS Chapter 432. The board's revenue shortfall is not associated in any way with the current economic downturn. It has been anticipated by the legislature since 1999, when the Transportation Economic Development Ways and Means Subcommittee directed the board to review its fee structure to determine whether or not a fee increase was necessary. The board came back to the Ways and Means Subcommittee in the 2001 session indicating that its analysis revealed that no fee increase was necessary because the board's cash balance was sufficient to absorb the difference between revenues and expenditures for the 0103 biennium. The Ways and Means Subcommittee agreed. However, they noted or commented, it wasn't a budget note, it was a comment, they commented that the board would no doubt need a fee increase for the 0305 biennium. The Budget and Management Division recommends that the board carry a 3 to 6 month cash balance to cover cash flow needs and allow for contingencies. Budget analysis indicates that without a fee increase, the board will end the 2003-2005 biennium with its cash balance depleted and about a $40,000 deficit. License fees were last raised in 1993, and I'll try and make a distinction here between license fees and the death certificate filing fee. The board licenses individuals and establishments. The individuals the board licenses are funeral directors, embalmers, apprentices, interns, and so on, and the establishments the board licenses are funeral homes, cemeteries, and crematories. License fees were last raised in 1993. The death certificate filing fee was established at $5 during the 1985 legislative session. It was intended to provide revenue for the board to implement a number of major reforms passed in the wake of the Omsberg incident. Very briefly, the Omsberg incident had to do with a funeral director in Lincoln City who was found to have horribly abused quite a number of human remains. At the time, there was the funeral director and embalmers board, but no agency had regulatory responsibility for crematories and cemeteries, and there were quite a number of other reforms made with respect to the paper trail that follows human remains after someone dies. During the 93 session, the legislature established a second death certificate filing fee. It was a $2 fee intended to fund what's known as the Indigent Burial Fund. It allows funeral homes to obtain a small portion of reimbursement for taking care of the final disposition of those who don't have the resources to do that for themselves. Those two fees were combined in 1997 to form the current $7 death certificate filing fee, but the $5 portion received by the board remains at the same level that it was back in 1985 when the fee was first established. In May of 2002, the board established a fee structure advisory committee for the purpose of making a recommendation to the board as to how a fee increase should be structured in the event a fee increase was necessary. That committee did not include board members. It was made up of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, the Cemetery Association, and a consumer group known as the Funeral Consumer Alliance that has about 12,000 members in the state of Oregon. There were also a couple
Funeral Consumer Alliance.
Funeral Consumers Alliance.
Very interesting group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a local branch of a nationwide organization.
Okay.
There were also a couple of representatives there from some of the larger corporate owners of the death care facilities in the state of Oregon. After deliberation through two meetings, the advisory committee reached general consensus on the following recommendation. And I'll quote here, in the event a fee increase is necessary for the 2003-2005 biennium, the fee structure advisory committee recommends that the board raise the death registration filing fee. Among the committee's among the reasons for the committee's recommendation are that, one, the death registration filing fee was established for the express purpose of providing revenue for the board to carry out its responsibilities. Two, the $5 portion of the death registration filing fee that provides revenue for the board has not been raised since the fee was first established in 1985. Three, with an estimated 60,000 deaths per biennium in Oregon, increasing the death registration filing fee can produce considerable revenue without significantly increasing the overall cost of final disposition. And four, unlike licensing fees, the death registration filing fee applies equally to all deaths in the state of Oregon. As such, raising this fee constitutes the most equitable and straightforward means of generating additional revenue to support the board's programs. During its regular meeting on July 23, 2002, the board concluded that a fee increase was necessary and made a unanimous decision to accept the Fee Structure Advisory Committee's recommendation to increase the death registration filing fee. After considering a range of options from $5 to $7, the board decided to propose an increase of $7 effective January 1, 2004. Looking forward, the board concluded that the fee increase ought to be sufficient for revenues to meet expenditures.
Can I ask a question, please? Just so I'm clear, that means then that the current fee would go from 7 to 9?
No, the current fee would go, the portion that the board receives would go from 5 to 12. It's a $7 increase.
I see, okay.
There's a $2 indigent burial fee, so the total fee would be $14.
Okay, thank you.
If enacted, the proposed $7 increase will generate an estimated $315,000 in new revenue during the 03-05 biennium. SB 347 is directly linked to the board's budget policy package number 171.
Okay.
There are two main alternatives to increasing the death certificate filing fee. The first is raising licensing fees, and the second is reducing expenditures. Oregon has a combined regulatory scheme. It's unique nationwide. Most states continue to regulate the funeral, cemetery, crematory components of the industry separately. Oregon has combined all that, those functions into one separate board. It has significant advantages with respect to cost effectiveness and the reduction of overlapping regulation and consumer protection, but there is a problem arises whenever there's an effort made to set fees and attempt to allocate the fee burden fairly among the different components of the industry. Of necessity, the board allocates its resources as situations arise with one component of the industry or another. Because the factors that might be used to allocate the fee burden fairly are always changing and subject to opinion, it occurred to the board that efforts to raise license fees as opposed to the death certificate filing fee was apt to foment a certain degree of controversy, and I think the Fee Structure Advisory Committee sensed that and recognized that when the death certificate filing fee was launched in 1985, the legislature carefully avoided that problem by establishing the death certificate filing fee, which applies to all deaths in the state of Oregon, and it need not be allocated to one, to a cemetery or crematory. It applies to everyone. When the during the first biennium after the death certificate filing fee was put in place, it generated 57% of the board's total revenue. Filing fee revenue rose to 60% during the next biennium. That would have been 87-89. But by the 99-01 biennium, the last for which actual accounting data are available, revenue from the death certificate filing fee had fallen to just 34%. If license fees are increased to cover the impending shortfall, it is estimated that revenue from the filing fee will fall to about 26%, less than half the percentage generated during the first biennium after it was passed. The board seeks to avoid the potential controversy associated with raising license fees and restore the revenue balance in force when the death certificate filing fee was established in 1985. If a $7 increase is enacted, the filing fee will generate about 54% of the board's total revenue during the 03-05 biennium, and that figure is expected to rise to about 59% in the 05-07 biennium.
I think you've done a pretty good job of presenting your issues, Mr. Coe. Senator?
I have a zillion questions.
Go ahead.
Well, help me understand on table one where it has an effective, I'll just pick without an emergency clause, effective January 1st, 2004, and help me understand
the chart.
This chart. I know you have it incrementally based upon the level of the fee increase, but I don't understand the new revenue, the cash balance, the months, and I don't see your whole budget picture here as the difficulty I'm having.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, this table was presented in an effort to show how the board arrived at the $7 figure. And what it shows is that the new revenue that it will produce. It also shows that a $7 fee increase will, for the 0305 biennium will generate a six-month cash balance, which is within that 3 to 6 month standard that the Budget and Management Division has established for the board. But when you get to the 2003-2005 budget in column 5, that is a continuing service level figure that represents the governor's recommended budget for the board.
The governor said we weren't doing CSL.
The budget was put together, I believe, under the Kitzhaber administration, according to the instructions that the board was provided. And I've heard the same thing, and we weren't given any instructions to go back and redo the budget, but I've heard that same thing.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor this too much, but I'm actually a little confused by your documents, because you said something about 59% of revenue coming from the fee. Where's the other revenue come from for the
license fees?
License fees.
There's two principal sources of the fees.
See, I'd like to see the whole budget picture.
I'd be happy to get you the budget binder and would be glad to provide that information.
Yeah.
It's just I didn't know how much of that sort of information was appropriate to bring
forward.
I'd like to
see the whole thing if I can, because I know that the Republican caucus has charged members of our team to review these fees to make sure that they're appropriate and, you know, they're accurate. So without looking at all of the information, I'm uncomfortable moving forward.
Be glad to provide the whole budget document for you.
Okay.
The board is not proposing any program increase. This doesn't affect regulation, neither expands or decreases the scope of regulation or anything like that. This table simply shows that with a $7 filing fee, there's a variance in revenue and expenditure of $605, meaning that we wouldn't be requesting the kind of a fee increase that would produce a continuing deficit situation.
Right, I understand. And in fact, because it's incomplete information, I mean, it looks to me like you're eventually going to accumulate a substantial ending balance. So that's the question I want to get to, is what about future biennium? If you increase, you're literally doubling your fees, and based on the assumption of the number of deaths, it looks to me like your fiscal position will improve substantially. So unless you actually increase your operating expenses, your ending balance is going to grow substantially.
It's not intended to do that.
I understand.
Okay, but I'd be happy to provide those figures. Also, the next table shows the same sort of spreadsheet, but with an emergency clause as opposed to a bill that would become effective January 1.
In fact, that becomes more relevant if we understand the total picture in terms of what the overall ending balance is. And the other thing, Mr. Chairman, if I could, is your agency asking for any additional budget packages or budget additions in Ways and Means?
No, none. Well, the only one is a very small piece that was approved by the 2001 legislature. It is House Bill 5038.
It's not a new decision package that you're asking Ways and Means to add.
No, there's absolutely there is one reduction package that's associated with 5038, but that the one package that's before the legislature for ratification this term, the revenue generation there is $8,200, so it's minor.
Okay, thank you.
If I might just continue for a moment, Mr. Chair.
I actually think it'd probably be a good idea to just, we don't have our quorum here anyway, we weren't going to take any action. You need to meet with Senator Menace, and then I think once he's comfortable with your budget situation, then we'll bring you back up for a work session. Because we're probably going to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means anyway. We'll just keep the process going. We'll just have you meet with Senator Menace and bring your budget documents, and we'll go from there.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Who's your analyst, by the way, in Ways and Means? Who's the fiscal analyst?
Cindy Jones.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 347 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 383. And we have Senator Beyer here. Would you like to explain, Mark, what the bill does?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 383 limits number of persons in state management service and in certain state unclassified service to 13% of number of persons in certain state employment.
Thank you. We have Senator Beyer here, and do you have the witness?
Yes.
List? And we have Mr. Ludwig Hitz. So, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I may digress to the last bill, and I hope Senator Minnis will keep us apprised. It sounds like I'm even notifying my constituents when they need to die so they can avoid paying an additional fee. And if so,
sort of like PERS retirement, isn't it? You'll see a doubling of the list.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9, before you with Senate Bill 383. And I'm really here this morning, or this afternoon, I guess now, just to introduce Mr. Hitz. He's a constituent of mine. Mr. Chair, you may remember this bill. We introduced it last session also. We had a hearing on it, and we were kind of unable to move from that point in time on. We were kind of asked to try to get the number, what the management level is now, to see how it compares, this 13% figure, and time ran out on the session before we actually had a number back to actually find out where management is. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to introduce Mr. Hitz, who is was a longtime state employee. He's retired now, and he'd like to have him talk about his ideas with the bill.
Thank you very much.
Chair, Senator Cochran, and committee members, for 31 years, I went to jail almost every day. I was management for 10 years. I was a union rep. I was a union president for a number of years. We had a good legal firm representing us, Kulongowski, Drummond, and Hyde. But so, one of the
lucky
things I want to... Pardon?
I said, you're lucky you made it out.
Yeah. One of the things I want to bring up is on lines 8, 9, 10, and 11, it says 13% of the number of persons. Well, that, I think, is either a misprint or typo or something, because it should be read something like, I don't know how to word this stuff, but the number of persons employed by the state in a position of management together with the management support staff, i.e. secretaries, administrators, you know, whoever involved there, provided in ORS 240212 and the unclassified service described, may not be paid any amount that exceeds 13% of the budget of any given agency. And the reason I come up with that figure years ago when I took some economic classes in college, and that's quite a while ago, but I can remember the professor standing up there indicating that if we go over 13% of the wages paid in any agency or any business, we need to take a look at our plant makeup. A few years ago, 81, 83, somewhere in there, when Senator Bev Clarno was the head of the Ways and Means, I got a copy of the compensation plan. I got quite a runaround getting that, too, from the state agencies. And I took it up to her, and I pointed out where the management at McLaren School was running right at 30%. And they have various ways of hiding who's management and who's not, but it did come out to the right 29-30% when I figured it out. And we talked for a while, and she pointed out to a stack of papers on her desk, and she says, "See that?" And I says, "Yeah." And she says, "That's the same thing you just brought in from numerous state employees. I've talked to teachers that are friends of mine, and they've told me the same thing. There's an excessive amount of management in a lot of agencies. And I think it would be better off releasing some of those managements than perhaps inmates and state police officers and the rest of the people that are doing the work. I think you could probably gain maybe 5 million, 10 million. I don't know, it'd be hard to estimate for me throughout the whole state, but you probably gain quite a few million dollars throughout the state in the budget by doing this. I think one of the reasons they have so many management staff that are on deck is because I think a lot of them are inept. They pull people up out of the workload to do some of their writings, to do some of their research, because they're just not capable of doing it. And management was, well, the superintendent of McLaren School called me at home one time when I was union president out there, and we talked for a while, and he finally pointed out to me, he says, you know, what can I do to straighten this mess up out here at McLaren? I says, well, Chuck, I says, one thing you need to look at is what you got for management out there. And I says, what you need to do is lay about half of them off. And he says, I already tried that. I went downtown, they wouldn't let me. And I think the only way you're going to get management in line with proportions of employees being paid is probably with the bill of some sort. Maybe this bill won't do it, but of some sort that will force management to do that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hitz. I think I actually have represented state workers for 14 years, and I share a lot of your concerns. I do think that we're actually making some inquiries into Department of Human Services right now because of their restructuring. There's a lot of us that are very concerned that the management positions were shuffled but not removed, and so there's a big question about what kind of economies were had. And Gene Thorne will argue that only 4% of DHS is management. They do have ways to hide them in policy areas and that sort of thing. And I think some of it almost becomes definitional. But I think that you're onto a good idea here. I'm not sure, you know, it seems that you're not either on the 13%. But I think your bill is well-intentioned, and I think it's something that we're going to be looking at in the Ways and Means process. Yes.
Senator Corcoran, Mr. Chair, I think that this might be a good opportunity, because I think you actually hit on the very crux of the issue, and that is the definitional analysis of what is management.
And their support.
Yeah, and support, too. And I assume the support persons generally, there may be a ratio of support persons to management persons. And because I had the same feeling working in the Portland Police Bureau, I'm of the opinion that you could lay off every lieutenant in the department, you would notice a difference. In fact, oftentimes we've worked without a commanding officer for 6 months. That's not exactly, but a lieutenant for 6 months. Couldn't tell the difference. It was like, you know, somebody just didn't make a new memo and send it around the office. But I do think that it would be profitable for the state to go through a definitional analysis to define what we mean by this, and then maybe apply a percentage in some form, and then decide, you know, how that functions, how that works, because we don't have any standards right now, and it is easy to bury management personnel.
Maybe we can, in concert with this bill, bring in somebody from DAS to talk about the position inventory control, the PIC system, and how they, you know, there's classified management, there's the X's, you know, for the executive, and that might give us a little bit of a view, because, you know, in what's used to be Adult and Family Services, I don't know what any of these acronyms are anymore, but Child Protective Services, Adult and Family Services, they will tell you that they cannot find supervisors. You know, so there's some frontline management supervision stuff that's not happening. They'll say that there's a whole slew of them up here in Salem that are just, you know, pushing paper. So I think it might be helpful to, you know, have another hearing on this and bring in somebody from DAS and have them walk through some numbers with us.
Give me just a brief example. I want to just go back to the Portland Police Bureau, but I love beating up on those guys because I work for them. But Mayor Katz recently asked, after they concluded their budgets, and it was prompted because a number of people that were supposed to be laid off as a matter of budget reductions were actually still working in the Portland Police Bureau. And when the mayor found out that they were still working there, her question was very natural: how are you paying for these people? And as it turns out, they were paying from different pots of money. So I think the mayor appropriately said, I want an audit of all of your personnel positions, and I want to know where every single body working in that agency is actually working. It took them about 3 months. But they found over 300 errors with persons assigned to different divisions and functions, including myself, who they had assigned as the afternoon sergeant in the operations support unit. I'd been back in detective division for well over a year. So it took them 3 months to reconcile all of that. So they frankly, and this was the argument, was, well, we want to promote more lieutenants and we want to promote more captains and sergeants, but you know, the mayor's rationale is very accurate, is, well, I'm not promoting anyone until you can tell me where people actually are. And I think we probably have a similar problem in our state government.
Well, I think I'll ask staff to bring in someone from DAS, and we'll try to hold another hearing on this in another week or so, and maybe invite you back. And if you want, we could specifically look at. You worked at McLaren, apparently.
I did, yes. Yeah.
I'd be happy to bring. How long have you been retired?
About 5 years.
I'd be happy to bring in just somebody from that particular unit and have a look at their, you know, their staffing.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
For information, the ORS that cited 240.212 is a definition of manager in the statute, and maybe we need to look at that definition also, because maybe that's not an adequate definition. And I'd be happy to work with your staff to have an amendment drafted, or to, you know, maybe if it took Portland Police Division 3 months to figure out what they were doing, maybe that's why it took us the entire session last year. That we got to get a number to get to 13%. We never did get a number before we closed session, so.
Yeah. Well, higher education, I mean, that was an area that I worked in and with the unions, and what they did in higher education when they created the Oregon University System was that they reclassified tons of people into a title of officer of administration, and they were, you know, neither fish nor fowl. They weren't classified employees. They weren't considered management employees. They didn't supervise anybody, and it made their numbers. It made them look incredibly top heavy. So, I think some of this is it's definitional and it's structural. You know, I mean, what is a person that just does federal policy, you know, in an adult and family service setting? I mean, they're clearly not working in the field, but they're clearly needed because, you know, everything's so rule-bound. So we'll do that. We'll hold another hearing.
Like I say, Mr. Ellsworth, our administrator here, I think has a lot of background in organizational structure, too. So perhaps we can stick him on this problem.
Okay. That's a deal.
Chair, can I add something to what Vice Chair Senator Minnis said? A friend of mine worked corrections for about 31 years, from sheriff department to jails to penitentiaries, and he knows a lot of parole officers. And he was down in Eugene. He walked in the parole office down there, just, you know, he just happened to be there, and he said, "Well, I know some of these guys." And here he went in there, and when he was walking in, a guy was coming out, and he knew him, and he talked to him for a while, and he says, "You won't find anybody but one guy." And he said, "You lay a whole bunch off?" He says, "Well, they're out of the office now, but you'll find one guy in there. It looks like we laid a bunch off." So it's, like I say, they do the same thing that they were doing up in Portland, I guess. And I've seen management on my time off out shopping on their state time, too. You know, so.
Well, I mean, you know, bad management and just too many managers are two different questions. And I mean, we do have a solution for bad management. You just have to have good enough management to do what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
But so I'm not really interested in that kind of bashing. But I do think that there's a real structural question that you raise with the bill that deserves a look, especially in these economic times. And I will say that the probation guys are woefully understaffed in Eugene, and they really only have one supervisor, as far as I know, for about probably 25 parole and probation officers. So that particular agency, I don't think, is a center in this particular case.
Thank you, folks, very much. Close public hearing on 383, and we will open see where we are here. One more left here, folks. We're going to eliminate some redundancy. House Bill 2317, open a public hearing. And tell us what this bill does, please, Mark.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2317 eliminates redundant provision in statute prescribing membership of the Capital Planning Commission, increases the number of commission members appointed by the governor from 3 to 4.
I've been waiting for this bill all day.
These guys are good. We can beat up on that.
Okay, do we have a sheet here? We have Lori Wadner and Doug Capps, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lori Warner. I'm the Facilities Division Administrator for Department of Administrative Services. And with me is Doug Capps, who is the Administrator for the Capital Planning Commission.
Welcome.
Thank you. This bill before you came out of the House rather quickly, and we didn't have a chance to make this one amendment that we have before you today. So I'll briefly describe it. This shouldn't take too long. DAS is proposing that in order to maintain the current and historical balance of the Commission, that this be amended. The bill was a housekeeping bill out of Ledge Council for you, and when DAS was two separate departments, it was at one time the Executive Department and General Service Department. The statute required that there was a member appointed by the director of the exec department to the Capital Commission, and also one appointed by the General Services Department to the Capital Planning Commission. When the two agencies merged, then there was language left in there that said the director of Department of Administrative Services that replaced the other two entities would appoint two members, and Ledge Council felt that that wasn't appropriate and needed to be cleaned up. That's been 10 years ago or so since that change, but it's been on the books that way, and it's continued to function. So the commission currently has 9 members. Two of them are legislators that are non-voting, and the other 7 are made up of 4 public sector members, 2 from the city of Salem and 2 from state government, and then 3 private sector members. So what the amendment would do would be simply change the governor's appointment to remain at 4 members, but the 3 of them be private and 1 of them from the public sector, so you maintain the same balance on the commission. So that's what the amendment does that we're asking you to consider.
Okay. We're into conceptual reality again here. Should we have this done the right way, or should we do it the wrong way again?
It's pretty simple, isn't it?
Looks pretty simple to me, although this, I presume this document was created by...
That's our amendment that we created. I don't think that's been through Ledge Council from talking to the committee administrator.
It's a House bill. We've got plenty of time.
So just go ahead and get it done right. Okay. Can we do that then, and just have you folks back, one of you back before us, presumably, once we get the amendments taken care of? Okay.
That would be fine.
Did you have anything you needed to say?
I don't think that'd be a good idea. Would it?
You're a smart man. Thank you, folks, very much.
Okay.
All right, we'll close the hearing, and we'll instruct staff to please get the draft started there. And I think otherwise, any other business to come before? So we're adjourned. Thank you guys very much.
You on the death title.